despite the fact that from a very, very young age, we're making kids go to school and we're imposing an educational ideal on them, it's not working. After 150 or 160 years of compulsory schooling, people are getting dumber, not smarter.
Welcome to Radio Free School.
My name is Matt Hearn, and I live in East Vancouver, British Columbia, where I run an alternative to school program for teenagers, and I work with a large democratic free school called Windsor House. People have drawn a distinction between unschooling and deschooling, but I don't particularly see it. My kids attend a place called Windsor House. I've got two kids. I've got an 11-and-a-half-year-old daughter and a daughter who's going to be six very soon, and they attend a place called Windsor House, which is the only free school in in the world that I know of, and I've looked long and hard. My partner Selena works Windsor House, and I used to. We consider Windsor House, which has got 200 kids now, by the way, it's a big prospect, to be more akin to a community center or a library. Even though it is run on basic Summerhillian kind of grounds, it's got school meetings, and there's non-coursive academics and stuff. Our kids, they attend it, and they're certainly like a part of it, but they don't go every day, and they don't go every day on habit, and they don't go any day they don't feel like going. So we use it more like a resource center. So yeah, I consider the project of what we're doing with our kids is difficult to name, but certainly deschooling is as close as it gets. It's funny because we grew up in a culture that perceives that kids are incapable of learning without being taught. And it's an idea that's very difficult to divest oneself of. But it's easy to see when you have children. Nobody would think to teach a one-year-old how to talk. One-year-olds learn how to pick up the most complicated languages in the world all of their own volition. And they don't need workbooks, and they don't need anybody sitting there, hawking over them and telling them how to do things and pretending that they're teaching them. But somehow 5 years later, we expect that kids need to be taught to learn how to read the exact same language that they taught themselves 4 years earlier how to speak. And I think it's absurd. And I've been around kids for the last decade, unschooling kids, and they all learn how to read, one after the other, in ways that are so enigmatic and so crazy and so incomprehensible to the outside viewer, but they all learn how to read. And I absolutely, completely am opposed to the idea of teaching reading in its entirety, because kids all want to grow up to be competent, they want to grow up to be literate, they want to grow up to be smart, they want to grow up to be capable people. Nobody wants to grow up to be stupid and ignorant, and certainly nobody wants to grow up to be illiterate. Sometimes kids learn how to read late, typically boys, frankly, for reasons that I couldn't even begin to guess at. But kids learn to read between the ages of 4 and 15. Some kids learn early, some kids learn very late. But by the time they're, mid-teens, the early learners and the late learners tend to be indistinguishable from one another. And that at some point, it's going to become an overwhelming priority for the kid to learn how to read. At some point, he's absolutely going to want to learn how to read, because there's no question that it's an important part of his life. And, at that point, the family and the kid can put all the resources together to figure out what it will take for the kid to be able to read. I frankly believe that everybody wants to learn how to read and is capable of learning how to read, except in the most extreme cases. I'm interested in the ideas of both cultural reproduction and citizen production in terms of the philosophical and political underpinnings of compulsory schooling. So if we're talking about what are schools for and what were they designed for? The initial project of developing schools was really begun in about 1806 with a guy called Fichte, who after one of the Franco-Prussian Wars and after Napoleon had stomped Prussia, recognized that Prussia had very little resources left over, and that the training of Prussian citizens to become good citizens and become good soldiers was paramount if Prussia was going to continue to dominate Central Europe. And so they designed, it's a long story, but developing a Prussian system of education involved, one of the main keys of it was developing a system of bells and ordered subjects, so that the students would be unable to decide what subject they were interested in pursuing at the time, but they would follow a series of bells and move from one subject to the other at the instructor's discretion. At the time, it sounded radical, but now we consider it to be completely standard. That's what schools are. You take a kid's day and you fracture it so intensively into little one-hour blocks and demand that kids change, move from subject to subject to subject, more or less at a random, more or less at random selection. One of the things that happens, and this is really important in developing soldiers, is that kids lose the capacity to make decisions for themselves. Because at the sound of a bell, you have to be able to go, bing, it's math, bing, it's science, and not be sit there and question, you know, why, what for, what am I doing this, I don't want to do this now, I'd like to do something else. The point is to be able to respond to authority and to respond to at a moment's notice without any questioning. And so if you expect kids to sit in a school all day long and respond to authority and respond to the sound of a bell in terms of what my next activity is going to be, and to be able to evaluate themselves in terms of other people's grades, in terms of other people's evaluatory mechanisms, then you're stuck with very little chance through the whole part of your adult or of your child, your growing life. So most of us spent our child, I certainly did, not directing any part of my own days. And so then all of a sudden, you graduate from high school, and you're 18 years old, and you're expected to be able to run your own life. People are like, why aren't teenagers more responsible? How come they can't take care of themselves? Well, they've never had the opportunity to do it. But if you begin to think of the possibility of little kids, you know, 2 years old, 3 years old, being able to think, I mean, from birth, really, from being able to make good, rational decisions about what they want to do with their time, based on the idea that people want to grow up to be healthy and competent and growing human beings. And that's just not, and I don't mean in an individualistic, you can do whatever you want. I mean, you know, within the context of family and community. I think you have to start with that idea, that people are capable of making good decisions about themselves. You have to believe that people are not born into original ignorance. The idea of original sin has something to do with the idea, although I'm not very religious myself, is that people are born sinful and need to be saved. The way that the idea of education has evolved in at least the Western mind is that people are born into original ignorance. And unless that they're somehow saved from their own ignorance, that they're going to be lost. And I think it's an idea that's worth scrapping, because, and I'm paraphrasing from Ivan Illich here, because people are not born into original ignorance. People are born natural learners and naturally interested in their world. And we all know this from being around groups of kids. There's nothing worse than standing in front of a group of kids, or even one or two people, and trying to, quote-unquote, teach them something that they have no interest in. It's terrible. It's dispiriting. Nobody wants to do it. Everybody sits there, and the kids or the group of people are trying to get away, and they're not thinking about it, and it just doesn't go anywhere. It's totally painful. But if you're with a group of people who are very interested in learning what you're talking about, or interested in learning and what's in front of them, it just goes like, and I hesitate to use this word, but it goes like magic. People pick up things so fast and so quickly, it's amazing. Compulsory schooling, it's inefficient. It doesn't meet even the very narrow standards by which it's set for itself. If you go to the No Child Left Behind website, which is the title of George W. Bush's education policy, which is that no child will be left behind, and you look at the first graph they offer you, there's these, you know, monstrous numbers in terms of increases of spending. In fact, education spending in the United States has doubled since 1985. There's an incredible amount of money being spent on education, $700 billion last year in all levels of education. But what you'll also notice on that same graph is there's a straight line right across the middle of the spending, which indicates reading competency. And for the last 30 years, nothing has changed. Fourth graders in the United States, only 32% of fourth graders can read competently. And that hasn't changed. So despite the fact that from, you know, a very, very young age, we're making kids go to school and we're imposing an educational ideal on them, it's not working. So not only is it not a good way to live, I don't believe it's an effective way to live, and I think the numbers bear that out. After 150 or 160 years of compulsory schooling, people are getting dumber, not smarter.
Listening to Radio Free School.
once you're directing yourself, once you're learning about the things that you're most interested in, pursuing the activities and the goals and the interests that are actually stem from inherent motivation, not external motivation, I think it just works better. People learn quicker, they learn better, and they have more fun doing it. So I think the idea of self-design, even though it's complicated and has to sit within a rubric of community, I think that once homeschooling and deschooling starts to descend into just kind of crude individualism, it becomes more of a libertarian philosophy. And the idea of education and the wider ideas of learning, they're social questions, and they have to be conceived of socially. I think once they begin to be perceived as individualistic questions, the ideals begin to fall apart. There's no question that a lot of deschooling, and certainly a lot of my philosophical stance, sits itself within an anarchist tradition, more specifically a social ecologist tradition, which suggests that the questions that we're facing, the major social questions, in particular the larger ecological questions, have to be conceived of as social problems. And they have to be conceived of as stemming directly from people's domination of other people, which enables people's domination of the natural environment. A couple of years ago, I noticed that a lot of the kids that I had been part of my life for a long time, that had become teenagers, 15, 16, 17 years old, were, even from the age of about 14, were starting to drift away from Windsor House. Windsor House is a relatively large school, but it has a very kind of family, kind of warm and kind kind of atmosphere. It's a community in and to itself. It has its own institutional community, its own institutional logic. And teenagers, I think almost by definition at a certain point, 14, 15, 16, begin to look into the wider world. They want to begin to assert themselves in a wider world, and they want to look around, and they begin to slowly pull themselves out of familial kind of surroundings. And I noticed a lot of them were drifting away from Windsor House and weren't really finding anywhere to sit. Weren't really finding, you know, where some of them were attending high school, some of them were just kind of drifting around, some of them were getting jobs, some of them were kind of attaching themselves to college programs, but there was no kind of institution for deschooling kids that I'd really heard of, or there was none in Vancouver. So I sat down with seven teenage friends of mine. This would be in the fall of 2000. And we just sat down, we just started talking about what would it look like if we could start a place for teenagers. And we say youth, and by youth we mean 15 to 25, which seems, it's a bit of an arbitrary guideline, but it seems to work for us. What would a place look like? And we just started batting around ideas. We had no money or anything like that, so me and these seven other kids, and I grew to eight kids after pretty shortly, we all started putting $20 a month into a pot and just seeing what could happen. And we just started batting around ideas. We started about starting a business. We started talking about starting a cafe. We talked about all kinds of different things. And at some point, we ran into a grant, about $15,000 or $16,000 grant from a local organization. And we opened a center called the Purple Thistle Center. And we opened an idea with all kinds of ideas, but we weren't really ready. But we had pretty much a clean slate. We had a nice space, and we live in a kind of downtown neighborhood, so space is difficult to come by, and a bunch of ideas. And we just started batting around ideas. And eventually what we did is we came up with some big guidelines, or some big loose kind of, I guess we can call them subject areas, of things that people were interested in. And I think they're, if not universal, they're very common things that teenagers are interested in. Art, writing, video production, music, theater, traveling. And we started talking about, okay, if we could do things, if kids could do things in those areas, what would it look like? And so we started gathering kids in groups of between 5 and 15 in each one of these kind of areas. And we set up little teams, or like little working groups of kids. And we hook them up with a community mentor, somebody in the community, sometimes an adult, but not always an adult, that has stuff to share. And we work on two bases. The first is that skill development. So, for example, you know, in the writing group, we develop the kids' ability to write in various genres. We read to each other. They work in a whole bunch of different kind of spheres. The second piece is that we're interested in doing some kind of community project with each group, so that not only is it just skill development and personal development, but it's working in the community as well. So, like, the art group, for example, right now is doing, there's 12 kids working on a great big huge mural at the community center. It's a big huge 3D mural about the history of the immigrant work experience in Vancouver. But each one of these groups, and currently we have, like I say, all right, we have an art group, we have a writing group, we have a photography group, we have a film group, we have a travel group, we have an exchange group, we have a direct action group, all working at the same time out of this little place. And so we schedule different times for ourselves, and then the kids just go for it. They go for it as much as they can. We have a whole bunch of other side projects. Mm-hmm. We have Spanish classes, and we have bikes classes, and we have sexual education and health stuff, and just whatever we can think of, we do. The whole center is run totally, well, it's not run democratically because we don't sit and vote on it. But what we do is every Monday night we meet, and anybody that's part of the center, and there's probably about 60 kids that's total that come, you know, at least once a week. Everybody's invited Monday night. We have food and all that kind of stuff. And there's always, we always try to keep as much food as we can at the center. And we just sit and make decisions. And I try to inculcate a family-style atmosphere because a lot of the kids are from the inner city. A lot of kids don't have real great family structures. And so we're trying to make it a home away from home, and we're trying to inculcate an atmosphere of kindness and of love and a place where people can make decisions and have their voice heard, but not in a one-person, one-vote atmosphere, but in a way that we just make decisions. We call it the tagline for, I think it's called the Purple Thistle Center, but it's an alternative or a supplement to school. And that's because it's true, and also because that makes our acronym ASS. But there's lots of kids that are in school. We've got kids from, we've got homeless kids that sleep under the bridge, under the SkyTrain bridge, and that are 15 years old. We've got kids that are 23, 24, and that are in upper level of university. And we try to keep everybody just mixing together without any kind of ghettoization of the kids that haven't been to school or kids that are in university or whatever. Because I think that's too often, you know, poor kids get shunted off together, or university kids just spend time with other university kids and think that people that aren't, you know, in post-secondary education or whatever don't have enough, don't have intellectual stuff to share, and that's not true. So, yeah, and it really, honestly, it hasn't taken all that. I mean, it's taken a lot of work, but it hasn't taken a ridiculous amount of work because there's just some... If one thing teenagers have is energy and enthusiasm and optimism for the world, and they're eager, they want to do stuff. It's not a question of being able to do enough. It's a question of just, I'm the director of it, and I just kind of just, we just try to keep enough going. But the problem is of supply not keeping up with demand. There's just endless stream of kids who are coming through my office every day that want to do something. Can I do this? Can I do that? Can I do this? Can I do that? I want to do this. I want to do that. And some of it's crazy and some of it's not. But just trying to keep up and trying to help kids facilitate their dreams is... It's just a never-ending barrage of stuff that kids want to do. And it makes me laugh when I think of kids that see, people say the kids are, you know, just lazy and want to sit around and watch TV all the time. It's just a literally, and I can't emphasize this enough, it's just an unbelievable stream of things kids want to do. As the person who tries to facilitate and just tries to hook other people up with other adults and try to find money for projects and try to find places, just there's no way I can keep up. The idea is different, is that most community centers or youth centers, if you've probably had them in almost every city, is to try to get kids off the street, is to try to get kids out of trouble, and that's a very common phrase. And I think it's, and so you, what you'll see is you'll see kids, you know, youth centers, they have video games, they have pool, and they have ping pong and stuff, and that's all cool or whatever, but it strikes me as condescending to kids. Get out of the way, let adults do their thing, and just kind of wait until you're an adult and you can be part of this stuff. So our kind of little shtick is to do something different. It's get kids on the street and highlight for both the community and them that they can make a real positive contribution to community culture.
The billboard space faces a big plate of crap straight from a frozen packet, cloned in stacks and then packed into the foam and plastic. Got matching doodad attachments and natural flavor from a lab sickness. This tick blip within the grips of double click victims of fictitious fact and fashion. Got them passionate about trends and attending events through TV's lenses. Just a consensus built from unending mention and attention. Shoppers were airdropping shit into your heads until your force fed this BS until you conform or you're dead on meds with three kids, a TV, DVD, and vids, washers, dryers, fridges, kitchens, and bathrooms, fixtures, mixtures of nutritious dinners for middle-class pantries, the shoes and pants with the stamp so that your kids could get asked to the dance and you could perhaps advance your lineage and then one day your king could live among the privileged. We want love and we need the desire and we want consumption, one urge, one drive, but something come on. Thank you.
do you like school, Billy? Close.
You are listening to Radio Free School.
Movie reveal.
Oh, it was good.
Up there's a big yellow screen. It was waiting for people to get off, and then it's open the seats and a little path going down and to the seats, and he got a bag of popcorn.
In the night, I hear it. Well, in the night, well, I hear the whale.
I like whale riders because the part that I most like is when she got on the whale and when her hair is blowing that clock back. She went underwater.
Whale riders. Oh, there's a girl called Pikea. Mm-hmm. She's 12 years old. And she's... Her grandpa didn't want to admit that she was the real chief. And so he was angry when her
dad...
wanted to call her Pikea.
She just knows what she's destined for. Then even though her grandfather didn't want her to become the next chief, she was the next chief. And then in the beginning, the mother's last words were Pikea, Pikea. She just kept saying it. And then the grandfather was very angry when the father said he was going to call her Pikea because that's the name of the first whale rider chief.
What was her experience as a girl trying to learn the things that traditionally only boys were taught?
She had to listen for, she was like peeking through the window and listening and watching the fighting matches they did together and doing all that. And she had a stick with her that time because they fight with a stick. So she wasn't listening. Like in the beginning, when she went to the school, she sat down on the front seat and said, "You're okay, you're a girl." Sit in the back and said, and she didn't move. And said, "Did you hear what I say? Sit in the back." And she didn't move. And then he said, "Sit in the back." And then she didn't move. And he said, "Sit in the back or leave," and then she left instead. Mm-hmm.
So, Whale Rider, would you tell your friends to go see it?
No, I don't like it much.
You like Whale Rider much?
I didn't like it much. It wasn't interesting if you couldn't hear what they were saying. Because I couldn't hear what they were saying because they spoke differently. They lived in New Zealand. I didn't like the way I couldn't hear what was said. Too many grown-ups, not enough children.
Were there things about the movie that you liked?
I liked the scene, but I like the scenes of the ocean. They're very pretty.
I like Whale Rider so much. At first I thought it was boring when the mother was dying and everything. But then when we came more from the longer part, then I became... to get tired and love it. And when it was time to leave, I felt like I wanted to watch it again. Mm-hmm. But I knew I couldn't. Go, 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 go. And
baby, deep blue sea. but got drowned in the deep blue sea. Dig his grave up with a silver spade.
Contact Radio Free School at grassroots@hwcn.org or mail P.O. Box 19, 1280 Main Street West, Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, L8S1CO.